My name is Andrew Hunter. I'm the senior curator at the Art Gallery of Guelph, and I am here in Edwardsville, Illinois, across the Mississippi from St. Louis, Missouri, and I am here with
Corey Wilmot of the Department of Anthropology at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
It's very long.
It is.
Yeah. And I'm here for a couple of reasons. Mainly I'm here because Jeff Thomas, artist who we will be working with at the Art Gallery of Guelph, has an exhibition here, which we're going to talk a bit about. And his work has focused a lot around the Mississippian culture and the Cahokia Mounds that are here. So I really wanted to come down and see that landscape and that history that Jeff is dealing with, and then also the opportunity at your invitation, Corey, to speak to students here at the university about curatorship and museology and being an artist and birdmen. So, yep. So Jeff's project is called Birdman Rising. But let's start with who you are. So, I mean, you have some history in Canada. You've been here since 2004, but tell us a bit about who you are.
Sure. I am actually an expat Canadian, but I had lived in the States, so I have dual citizenship. So when I finished my PhD from McMaster, and then I did a postdoc at University of Winnipeg with Jennifer Brown, working in the HBC archives, I was looking for a job, and I really wanted to get a job at a university that had a museum. Right. That I could use heritage items in my teaching practice.
Right.
And so, although I had never heard of Edwardsville, when the job ad came up and they were looking for someone who did Native American studies and museum anthropology, it was a great match for me.
Right.
And so when I came down here first for my job interview in 2004, I did really fall in love with the area. There's so much history here. The fur trade history is so fascinating and in many ways similar to Winnipeg, where I just came from. And so it did work out that they hired me, so I came. Yeah. I'm not an archaeologist. I am a cultural anthropologist, a museum anthropologist, and my area of specialty is actually clothing in intercultural relations and colonial relations in the Great Lakes region, Anishinaabe. So I'm kind of on the southwestern edge of where my area of expertise is, but in teaching Native American studies here under the shadow of Cahokia Mounds, the largest earthworks in North America, you really have to be a generalist because people here are used to the disappearing Indian has literally disappeared. The
right.
The biggest Indian presence here is those who have left the area,
yeah.
Either pre-contact
it, yeah.
Or in Edwardsville itself in 1817, the government land agent, Benjamin Stevenson, and one of the local Shoto boys, the fur traders from St. Louis, signed a treaty here with a Kickapoo. No land was granted. It was just, we'll give you, I don't even know what they gave them.
Right.
But they booted them out, basically, and then they started doling out parcels of land, and that's how it kind of went in Illinois. There are no reservations in Illinois.
No mm-hmm. treaty settlement.
No
yeah.
treaties, no reservations. Yeah. So it's very different addressing Native American histories and culture in this part of the
yeah.
world, because
yeah, and it's interesting as you've been talking about, and Jeff is interested in that we're sitting in the heart of, and I'll ask you to talk to explain more to people what Cahokia is,
mm-hmm.
but this really remarkable, important site, which has relevance not just here but beyond in this whole sort of Mississippi Basin and up towards the Great Lakes and down to the Gulf of Mexico. So you have this site that's of real importance to Indigenous history and Indigenous peoples, but a real lack of Indigenous presence within the scholarship, the interpretation with these sites, with the exception, I'm thinking of this one location in St. Louis that the Osage have recently acquired a mound. But tell us more about the mounds.
Okay, so the Mississippians' culture extended, I think the years are 600 to about 1150, Common Era. And so they were already dispersed before any of the Europeans got to this region. Archaeologists now have been tracing oral histories through the Osage, the Pawnee, and even the Sioux that they can link to the symbolism of the Mississippians. And so this new angle on interpreting their culture has been coming about in the last 15 years, I'd say, and that really, really sheds a lot more light. But just to say that this civilization was vast. In the numbers of people, I think we heard in the presentation this morning at the Interpretive Center, I think they said 50,000. But in fact, when they did the dig for the Mississippi River Bridge in these past, it's been going on over 7 years or so, and they had a small little area of, you know, less than an acre where they found over 1,000 houses. They realized that if you multiplied those numbers over the extent that they already knew that the population was greater than that of Paris at the same time,
right,
greater than that of London at the same time. Mm. But now, they, you know, with these new findings, they're going, it was even, you know, 10 times bigger than we realized. It was continuous through this whole region. You know, it was just vast. And this is what really attracts Jeff to the area is, as an urban Indian, this idea of this urban indigenous culture at this site, you know, before Europeans ever came here.
Yesterday I was driving around to all of these sites. And it's a long distance from the main mound at Cahokia to sites within the city of St. Louis and around the river. So this was it wasn't just like a large urban center, but a suburban and outlying. So as people tend to think of a Western city, North American city, it's very similar in a way. It had a city center and a suburban agricultural lands around the periphery.
Absolutely.
Right, and towns,
and even the archaeologists are calling these outlying regions suburban. I mean, because they're not, there's also little villages that are linked, you know, that are a little farther, and they believe they were bringing tribute and stuff, where you've got additional complexes, you know, religious complexes with, you know, so many homes around them. There are really no other way to describe but to say it is suburban, because it is really continuous with the center at Cahokia Mound site.
Right.
A Monk's Mound in particular, and being the largest earthworks in North America, and also connected with a whole complex of mounds of various different kinds, and the Woodhenge site.
Yeah. And what we've sort of heard from what you shared, from what the folks at the site today, there was a lot of debate in the 19th century among settlers about whether these were naturally forming or man-made cultural traces. And then by the 20s, that seems to be, the consensus seems to be that these were man-made. There is a cultural history. And then you start to see this movement towards a museum and acquiring and preserving the lands, right?
Yes. So when I first came here, more particularly, it's kind of tapered off, interestingly, just the tail end these years. I used to meet older people who had farms around here, and all of them are like, you could just walk around picking up artifacts. So it's really hard to imagine how they could have possibly construed that there were not, you know, large numbers of Native Americans around here, you know. Mm-hmm. And even back then, they were picking up significant pottery and tablets and carvings with obvious effigies, human and animal and so on, that had symbolism on it, and shell gorgets and what they called cups, because they had, you know, a psychoactive drug that called the black drink that their priests would drink from these whelk cups. Mm-hmm. Whelk cups are going to be traded from the Gulf Coast, right? So this is part of this vast trade network.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they had copper, too. They were trading for copper.
Yes. So that was something that intrigued Jeff, too, was that had a significant encounter with the Rogan plates at the St. Louis Art Museum, and their pounded copper images of Birdman. And this Birdman concept is something that Jeff's been tracing, you know, throughout his career, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. And it goes back to his powwow photograph. Before we talk about what he's done here in the show, talk about your decision to reach out? Because you've known Jeff or know of his work for a while. You used to work in Toronto. You worked in the Indigenous community in Toronto. And so why bring Jeff down? Why invite Jeff to come here and work with him here in Edwardsville? I mean, it's to me, having been here, it's obvious, but share with our listeners why Jeff.
Jeff and I have a series of non-coincidence coincidences. You know, it's kind of one of those relationships where, you know, like if you believe in anything beyond the beyond, you know, there's always something else and bigger than ourselves going on with that relationship. And the first one was I was meeting Ruth Phillips for the first time in Ottawa, trying to decide whether she was going to be my supervisor. For my PhD, I ended up going with Trudy Nix at the ROM. But anyway, Jeff's opening at Ottawa Art, and yeah. So was his show at the National Archives. That was up at the time and the opening. So we went to the opening, and Ali Kazemi was shooting Indians. And so I ended up in the video, but I didn't know that until I was at the Toronto Film Festival, and it was at the premiere showing of this film, and I was in it. We were in the audience.
Just to clarify, the film is about Jeff.
The film is about Jeff, yeah. Uh-huh. And though, but I didn't meet him at that time. That I think it came out in 95 or 97 or something like that. But I didn't meet him until 2006 at the first GRASAC meeting in Ottawa. GRASAC is the Great Lakes Research Alliance for the Study of Art and Culture, Aboriginal culture, depending on who you ask. But anyway, right. Everyone calls it GRASAC. Mm-hmm. And I was a founding and core member of that starting back in 2004. Our goal was to do collaborative collections research among academics, museum professionals, and Aboriginal community members. And these are non-exclusive categories. You could be all three, you know, or one or the other, or mm-hmm. so on, right? But the idea was to have conversations around collections and then to enter them in a database and then roll it out to communities.
So people would know where things were.
Yeah. My particular goal as a person who had learned beadwork and leatherwork in the Toronto Native community and actually taught bead and leatherwork, my goal was to use photography to revitalize that beadworkers, I call them community artists, they're not like selling in art galleries, but they're making art for the community so that they would have access to images and techniques through the photography, not necessarily having to go all around the world, you know,
to
have access to these images and techniques. These motifs and techniques. That was my goal. We all had our, you know, slightly different goals. But anyway, Jeff was at that meeting, and that was the first time I met him. We met on a few different occasions, you know, just on and off, accidentally. And then I think in 2015, it was again through Ruth Phillips. She sent an email to me and David Penny and said, hey, Jeff is interested in doing something on Mississippian culture. Do either of you know anything? And I said, hey, I live half an hour from Cahokia Mounds, the center of Mississippian culture, and I would love to, you know, host Jeff Thomas coming down here. So me and my colleagues in our Native American Studies program got funding for Jeff to come down.
Great.
And at that time, Jeff and I were really focusing on kind of the portraiture aspect of his work. Right. He'd always be interested in, you know, Edward Curtis as a portrait artist. Mm-hmm. And he's always interested in connecting with the person, you know, the personness, the humanity, you know. Mm-hmm. And so for me as a collections photographer, I'd always worked with GRASAC, and we were always, and as an artist, actually, always aware of the living quality of heritage items, mm-hmm. you know, of what's infused within them and the spiritual animateness and the personality of them. But in working with Jeff, really took that to another level I always want to capture data. I'm going, you know, I'm thinking, okay, what do other people need to know from this visual information in order to do what they need to do, right? But with Jeff, it really changes the question when you're behind the camera to who am I looking at?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and what would I ask? What would I, you know, like he's very much interacting
with
as a living
the piece,
thing.
As a living thing. And this was really, really fascinating to me. So when we worked in the collection here together, it was very experimental. At that time, we had no documentation for any of the pieces. And I had sort of abstractly heard, well, many of them may not be authentic, but I was, you know, I was really wasn't focused on that. We weren't focused on that at the time. We were really more focused on this kind of dialogue around ways of seeing through photography and encounters. And it was the first time Jeff had started this conversation with three-dimensional works mixed in with his photographic practice. Right. It was very experimental. So
yeah, and that's what's interesting seeing the show is like a lot of the images. I've known and worked with Jeff for a long time, so there's lots of imagery in this new series of triptychs and that are from much earlier series.
Yeah.
Where he was responding to Edward Curtis, powwow photographs, but again, weaving together as a kind of hybrid artist curator these things.
Right.
Which is fascinating, right?
Yes, it is. He picked the works that he wanted to include, and we worked together very closely to build the interpretive narrative. Mm-hmm. And using some of the historic images from the Missouri History Museum,
right,
as well as a few from other places, mm-hmm, George Catlin's work, yeah, that came in to the interpretation of one series of Seeing Eye to Eye and so on. One of my goals in working with Jeff was to sort of weave the narrative from the prehistory through the history to the contemporary, because our audience in this area will have a hard time making those connections just left to their own devices,
yeah,
you know?
So that's interesting, because we were talking earlier today about that, about having somebody, an artist like Jeff, come down, because this sense of like erasure,
yeah,
that you're in this space that both, on one hand, you're so conscious of being in an indigenous space because of the mounds,
yeah,
but you're also conscious of the weight of settlement and the driving out of indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of myth of the vanished indigenous, or as they say in the U.S., Indian,
yeah,
is heavy.
Yes.
And so talk about how, like, why you felt it was important to have, within that context, Jeff come and do the work here, right? Because as you were saying, in a certain way, things aren't quite as progressed as far, maybe other places, around relationships between institutions and museums and collections and indigenous.
So we have, actually it's fairly recent, Native American Studies minor program, and we have a speaker series. We bring in Native American speaker every term. And for many of our students, that will be the first and only Native American they've ever met.
Right.
And so that was the context we brought Jeff in, and he spoke with our class, you know, public. He gave a public talk. I think that time he actually gave three talks. And so that's how we got him here.
Right.
And the collaboration, when we were working together, we didn't actually know it was going to turn into an exhibit. That kind of progressed later. But the original goal was really to... I teach a class called Contemporary Native Americans. So in this area, we have like lots of wooden Indians. I don't know if you've seen one yet.
Yeah, cigar store. Yeah.
You know, they're right out on the street. I saw one just the other day on the weekend carrying a little Easter basket, you know.
I saw one this morning when I went to get coffee.
And a lot of our students will have gone to, at some point, a school that has an Indian mascot for their sports team, and they're proudly displayed out there on their t-shirts, hats, and their their billboards and so on. And so the idea of contemporary Indians, when I teach about stereotypes, oftentimes my students really cannot distinguish. They really don't have the background to really at all understand what is an Indian, what is not, and what's involved in Indian identity or history, mm-hmm, or anything like that. And no, Jeff is so wonderful to engage with the students, because he does have such a generous heart,
yeah,
and he can explain it from a very personal point of view that people can really relate to, you know?
Yeah, and I think also, as has always been, like his self-identifying as urban Iroquois.
Yeah.
And this, you know, being so, his work really does emerge out of this sense of what does it mean to be an indigenous person in an urban setting,
yeah,
where you're so like finding the traces of that, and at the same time being very conscious of presence but absence,
right,
like invisibility. And I think, mm-hmm, yeah, he's like a kind of an ideal person to enter into that conversation, also because he bridges between artist and historian, and he works with archives. And, So the last thing I wanted to ask you a little bit about, because this interview will also be joined in with an interview with Jeff, so we'll bring it together. But can you talk a bit about the notions, ideas about authenticity in relation to objects that are in collections here? Because there were two threads I thought were interesting when, yesterday when we were meeting. One had to do with this, with fakes. There are clearly like a lot of things being fabricated to be sold, right, as authentic. So not just like I bought a reproduction. It was clearly a reproduction of a beaver bowl today. Nobody was pretending that it was anything but a ceramic beaver
Reproduction.
Thing. Yeah, and I also bought a snow globe and a baseball, which were clearly not authentic. Well, they were authentic baseball and
authentic
snow globe.
Tourist items.
Yeah, but they weren't.
Made in China.
So there is one path, which is, yes, people have been making things to pass off as authentic.
Yeah.
That's one path. The other, though, is something you've expressed a real deep interest, but also frustration, is the inability for the archaeologist to acknowledge the value and the significance of objects that might be have been produced recently but were produced for trade or whatever. They weren't produced to pretend to be something that they weren't. So, yeah, maybe talk about that, too.
Actually, I had some student researchers who were helping in the background research identifying the items, and we build what's called a comparative collection, and then we also consult experts. So when we came face-to-face with the more than likelihood fact that at least some of the items are definitely could not be authentic. Some of them could have been, but some, you know, definitely not. Then we had to start a new conversation about authenticity. And both Jeff and I sort of moved around where are we going to find truth and value in this, in this place we're in. Because we don't know they're absolutely, you know, we don't actually know. They're unknown, right? But what we do know is that there is this collector who was voracious in his and indiscriminate in his collecting, and we do know that there's this big market around this stuff, right?
So the market being, because people in this area knew that there were, like your collector, somebody, they were willing to produce things for people to buy.
Honestly, I want to know. I'm going to research this now. Yeah. You know, really interested. Who were these people who made them and sold them as if they were really
dug out of the ground?
Dug out of the ground. Yeah, I mean, that's really dark and evil. But it brings up this idea of where is the value? Where's the value? And Jeff and I both kind of came to the idea that the value is still the story in the conversation, that this that these can trigger. For me, as an anthropologist, I'm more interested in, okay, what were the oral histories that are linked with these images and the symbolism? And for Jeff, he's more interested in, you know, how is this piece in my narrative of journey and discovery and so on, in my journey towards Birdman kind of thing.
Yeah. And just to clarify for people, too, the Birdman we keep mentioning, the key kind of iconic object and image related to Cahokia is this small little
tablet
which has a Birdman figure on one side and a kind of snake skin on the other, and it really... That's become kind of the iconic, it's the image that's used all over, and it was found.
It's actually the state of Illinois, IDOT, Illinois Department of Transportation official logo. You'll see it
on bridges.
Yeah,
and Jeff makes connections, like he's interested in the Birdman, how the Birdman shows up in other indigenous cultures and spreads throughout North America, and those kind of connections are something that Jeff, I'll get Jeff to talk more about.
Like, really fascinating to me was that through researching the oral histories is that the Birdman is linked to fairly sophisticated astronomy.
Right.
You know, that they're tracking, and that wood henge there, right, is also involved with tracking the movement of the planets and the stars and so on.
Yeah, and wood henge is, like, it's a circle of poles, like the size of a telephone pole, and it's a big circle to the east.
West.
West. I'm totally upside down here. Yeah. To the west of the main mountain.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Those particular poles are reconstructed.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
But, yeah, they have reconstructed it as it would have been. Everyone's been talking about Redhorn, Morningstar, but there were brothers, Morningstar and Eveningstar.
Right.
And the story actually links to tracking their eclipses with the sun.
Right.
So their paths in front of and behind the sun. So to me, that's pretty sophisticated.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, that they're tracking that.
Yeah,
and it's
also something that doesn't happen on a daily basis. So it's vast depths of time to track these events. Right.
And so people look at these stories and perhaps they're thinking, oh, they're so violent and, you know, the brothers killing each other. But no, it's actually reference to these celestial events.
It's a way of understanding and explaining celestial events.
And so the bird man is the idea, it's the transformation of men to birds and, you know, and back and so on. But it's a metaphor for being able to see into these different types of knowledges.
Yeah. So the last thing I'll come back to again is this idea of trying to get particularly the archaeologists from this region to recognize the value of, say, we were looking at a basket the other day that's in your collection that was clearly made by an indigenous person. It's based on traditions. It was never made as a fake. It was made as an object to be traded or to be sold. And we would have, I would say, a parallel in our collection. We have a remarkable collection of Haudenosaunee beadwork, which was made in the late 19th, early 20th century.
Right.
Souvenirs that were sold by Haudenosaunee women at Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
They're not fake. They are what they are.
Right.
They carry on beading traditions.
Yeah.
But nobody's pretending that there was like a period and traditionally that people were making photo frames or whatever. But they are genuinely important, authentic objects.
Right.
So maybe if you could just, as a cultural anthropologist, you can talk about the pressures to dismiss often these kinds of things because they reflect cultural, interactions between indigenous and European settler or whatever.
I think it's been a very interesting voice, positionally, to be a cultural anthropologist working with an indigenous fine artist for a show in a fine art gallery, working with a archaeology collection.
Right.
Okay, there's so many things going on here. And my position is particularly in the middle, doing a kind of a juggling act. I've been very happy that we've been able to engage the archaeology community in these kinds of discussions, just to open up the idea that there is value in these artifacts, being able to trigger these conversations, you know, because they are so focused on the provenience, which I'm totally with them. You know, we got to know this.
Where things
came from.
Yeah.
But the opportunity to actually, you'd think, since we're all anthropologists, you know, archaeology, that there'd be more understanding among us. But this idea that as an anthropologist, we are so interested in the networks and the commercial engagements and so on that these tourist items brought about, that the connoisseurial collectors, that's another part of this, okay? So there's the art people who have been mainly engaging with that Harrington collection, and then there's the archaeologists, and both those people are going, no, this is all fake. You know, I'm in the middle of it going, well, some of it is actually really interesting just as what it is, as it may hearken back to different periods, you know, as a kind of a renaissance or something.
Right.
But at the time, it was circulating as tourist items. It wasn't pretending to be something else.
But then it gets absorbed as something else.
Well, the ones in the exhibit, I gotta say, for sure, at least three of them had to be arising out of a very shady kind of forgery situation, which I do not condone at all. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing.
But I think we were discussing earlier at the site. I mean, there were some folks who were really excited to collect. They wanted stuff, and people were prepared to provide it.
Right.
And that
right.
we've seen in other parallels. I mean, we have a situation controversial in the last couple of years in Canada of this remarkable find of this set of paintings by a member of the Group of Seven, which are highly doubtful, but people are so excited, you know, to make for that market.
I think that's one of the reasons why I included the historic area pipes in the exhibit, and Jeff was kind of like, why are you putting those pipes in there? And that was part of my contribution of bridging that prehistoric with contemporary, and in this in this area sort of between authenticity and inauthenticity. I mean, those items I know from other research that they're actually made by Native people in the 19th century, and they at some point were sold to someone to get in that collection. You know what I mean? And so there was that exchange moment where they changed value from something that might have been used by a Native person or maybe made for sale by a Native person at that time.
Right.
But I know they're from that time period.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And like you say, not necessarily made originally pretending to be something else. Where
right.
There are clearly objects that's what's going on. Somebody's like, I'm going to make this and I'm going to pass it off as some ancient artifact and I'm going to make money because I can get away with that.
The final thing is that there are certain genres of things like these prehistoric pipes that there creates this inflated market for them. And as soon as there's a market, then people are going to jump in and go, okay, I'm going to make this and get a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas most of the stuff I research, it wouldn't be worth your while to make a fake. But at the same time, there was a guy here previously that was culling that collection, getting rid of all his tourist art. And I'm going, no, wait, that's what I'm studying as an anthropologist.
And that's valuable.
That's what I want to know. Yeah. You know, I want to know what those things can tell us about what was going on in the tourist mark, in the colonial engagement of those time periods.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
I'm
looking forward to talking to your class today. And really thrilled to see the work that Jeff did here, and looking forward how this work here develops into the project that we'll be doing at the Arc of Guelph in a year. So,
And we had the opportunity to look at the real authenticated ones at the St. Louis Art Museum, the St. Louis Science Center, and the Madison County Museum when he was here this time. So that should be exciting for your upcoming show.
Yeah, very much so. Okay.
Thanks
so much. Take care.